The following is an MSS Crew production. Hello, ladies and gentlemen of the listening audience. Welcome to our MSS Veterans Day celebration and an evening of classic radio entertainment in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room at radioutofthepast.org. The date is November 11th, 2017, and tonight we are going to take a look at World War II from a somewhat unique perspective. What follows are the first two parts in an eight-part radio series, starting in the midst of the Great Depression and continuing through the year 1940. Some of this material might be familiar, but what counts here is the way in which it is presented. This, then, is a radio view of World War II as seen from the home front.
Hello, world. This is William B. Williams, and this is the home front. On Saturday evening, August 5th, 1945, people crowded the sidewalk outside the Majestic Theater in New York City, waiting to see the new Rodgers and Hammerstein hit, Carousel. About 200 miles away, President Truman was working late at the White House. About 7,000 miles away from Broadway and the Oval Office, it was already the future. Not just the time zone difference that made it Sunday morning, August 6th in the Far East, but because one airplane carrying one bomb was about to change the world in a flash.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
What a moment, what a feeling. The Second World War had ended. And for Americans, it seemed as though an entire generation had been born at the same instant. Life was moving, grooving, and improving for a people who only a decade earlier had hit bottom. What an extraordinary experience to live and relive. And that's what I'd like to do now with my colleagues Frank Gorin and Edward Brown. Just wander around the home front of the 30s and 40s in those years of the big bands, big events, and big decisions. And listen to how it happened, to get some feel of it again. If you want to come along, there's always room for one more, and it only takes a moment to get there. For people separated by the war, it certainly had been a long, long time. There's plenty of good news to go around, of course. Families were together again, rationing was ended, and assembly lines were retooling from making tanks and planes to turning out washing machines and automobiles. But not all the guys were coming home as fast as they wanted to, and it got a little unruly over there after they heard that the guys stationed in the United States were getting out first and were grabbing up all the girls, all the jobs, and all the seats in college. They thought the good life was beginning without them.
Out on Manzanella Beach, G.I. romance with Native Peach. All night long make tropic love. Next day sit in hot sun and cool off, drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
And that's what the good life seemed all about, the Yankee dollar, of which there seemed to be an unlimited supply.
Working for the Yankee dollar.
And Americans, with piled-up dollars and pent-up desires, were buying up everything in sight and everything out of sight on the black market. Prices went crazy. So did Congress, trying to figure out what to do about it. And millions of American workers went on strike for bigger paychecks. And that wasn't all. Even before VJ Day, people accused of being communists or subversives or loyalty risks were allegedly hiding in Hollywood and in the State Department and under every bed. This wasn't exactly the no-problem world that victory in war was supposed to create. But Mr. In-Between wasn't going to lead this parade. These were the boom years, the dawn of the American century, as they called it, delivery time and all those dreams interrupted by war and by that Great Depression that had emptied the pockets of Americans and left their hopes threadbare just a few years and an eternity ago.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
When Woody Guthrie sang that song back in the early 30s, 15 million breadwinners were out of work and 32 million Americans had no income at all. Whole families stood in bread lines and soup lines, victims of the crash of 29. The country, it seemed, just kept on crashing. President Herbert Clark Hoover avoided calling the situation a panic. He came up with another name, depression, and the word stuck. Beyond the White House and out across the land, a couple of million Americans were permanently on the move, like Bedouin tribesmen, riding the rods or boxcars of freight trains from one town or city or hobo jungle to another, in search of a square meal or a day's work. And as fast as they could be found by railroad security guards, they were thrown off.
Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
In the winter of 32, as the national suicide rate tripled, comedians like Eddie Cantor tried to ease the pain with humor.
Nowadays, when a man walks into a hotel and requests a room on the 19th floor, the clerk asks him for sleeping or jumping.
And I give him to you as your candidate, our great, glorious Californian, Herbert Hoover.
This campaign is more than a contest between two men. It is more than a contest between two parties. It is a contest between two philosophies of government.
The voters had already figured that out. While businesses were going belly up every day, the president seemed to be preaching a philosophy of no government at all.
Franklin D. Roosevelt, having received more than two-thirds of all the delegates voting, I proclaim him the nominee of this convention for President of the United States.
The Democrats picked as their man the governor of New York, who had been stricken with polio 11 years earlier. Franklin Roosevelt was a powerful symbol of success against the odds, and he won.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
We never see a headline about a bread line today. And when we see the landlord, we can look that guy right in the eye. We're in the money. Come on, my honey. Let's spend it, lend it, send it rolling on.
well, not everybody was in the money. But by the time of the next election in 1936, FDR's strategy of centralized crisis management had cut unemployment in half, doubled industrial production, pulled banks back from the brink, and caused profits to rise sharply. The Depression wasn't over, but FDR had smoked out the fear of fear.
Certainly not Walt Disney's Three Little Pigs, who sang that tune in a cartoon short subject during the Depression. Became something of a national anthem. The Wolf, of course, was hard times, fear of the future, and worry about the problems of Europe and Asia. But with faith and some fortunes rising, many Americans felt that the rest of the world would just have to look out for itself. Let me explain why this song by Al Jolson was more popular at the end of the 30s than at the start.
What care I who makes the laws of a nation? Let those who will take care of its rights and wrongs. What care I who cares for the world's affairs? As long as I can sing its popular songs. Let me sing a funny song with crazy words that roll along. And if my song can start you laughing, I'm happy, happy. I want to sing of Dixie's charms, of cotton fields and a mammy's arms. And if my song can make you homesick, I'm happy.
We'll return to the home front in a moment. Hollywood, through most of the 1930s, sent out conflicting signals on peace and war, pacifism and patriotism. Audiences would go from a farewell to arms to a call to arms and not know what to think. What was clear in 1938, as always, was that music and romance, not politics, kept the box office busy. For Warner Brothers' Robin Hood, Eric Korngold wrote a classically good score to help Errol Flynn's Robin in his sword play with Basil Rathbone's Sir Guy Gisborne.
You've come to Nottingham once too often. When this is over, my friend, there'll be no need for me to come again.
You know any prayers, my friend?
I'll say one for you.
The whole country sang and whistled the tune that Snow White's seven dwarfs sang and whistled as they picked away at their diamond mine. Their labors were a gold mine for Walt Disney. Snow White was the biggest box office hit of 1938.
Hollywood Hotel. Good evening. Just a moment, I'll connect you.
Hooray for Hollywood! You may be homely in your neighborhood.
Be an actor, see Mr. Factor. You make your kisser look good.
Go out and try your luck. You may be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood.
The big bands were big business. They sold lots of recordings and played to big crowds. And so Hollywood invited them out. Tommy Dorsey made movies, so did Glenn Miller. And Benny Goodman joined Dick Powell, Francis Langford, and stars galore in Warner's Hollywood Hotel.
Oh, hooray for Hollywood!
It's really got me. Hooray!
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 Hooray for Hollywood!
Hollywood!
Yeah!
In Vienna, Austria, in the early years of the 20th century, Berggasse 19 was a famous address. People would walk by hoping for a glimpse of Sigmund Freud, a middle-aged physician who lived there writing his provocative ideas, which he so curiously described as paranoia, megalomania, ideas about adult behavior resulting from repressed infantile fantasies. No one paid any particular attention to Felberstrasse 22, one of Vienna's hotels for men, or to the young Austrian part-time student and full-time dilettante who lived in room 16 and whose infantile fantasies were maturing in the disguise of political theory. In that room, shared with the heroes of Teutonic mythology and Wagnerian opera, littered with vile polemics against the Jews and with racist pamphlets on Aryan purity, in that room adorned with images of his mother whom he adored and yet abandoned in her dying days, in that room filled with hate for his dead father, a stern Austrian civil servant, in that room, Adolf Hitler dreamed his dreams.
Vor uns liegt Deutschland, in uns marschiert Deutschland, und hinter uns kommt Deutschland.
He carried his dreams from that room in 1913, disowned Austria, joined the German army, fought in World War I, and went into politics. He led his new Nazi party in ever larger protest against the Versailles Treaty that had ended the war and left the Germans shamed and desperately poor and vulnerable to his appeals to lost pride and almost forgotten glory. And they gave him votes. And he used those votes to bargain his way into becoming chancellor in 1933, to proclaim himself Führer, and to promise to rescue Germans everywhere and make them the masters they ought to be. He began by occupying the Rhineland in 1936 and by annexing Austria in 1938. And no triumph would be greater than his parade through the streets of Vienna. Now the fantasy was lived, not dreamed. Now he stood equal to Wagner's heroic Lohengrin. Now the Gestapo would go to Berghausen 19 to watch Sigmund Freud and put other Jews in fear, in jail, and in flight. Now he had conquered his father's country, and with it, perhaps, his father's ghost. Now he could look ahead to the rescue of Germans in Czechoslovakia. At home in America, when Kate Smith sang about the moon and a rose-covered valley and memories, it was just what people wanted. Not a martial air or a political anthem, but a love song about private lives, private hopes, private dreams, and individual freedoms.
We'll return to the home front in a moment.
May make a play for the caddy, but when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a boy,
that was the song that did it. Cole Porter wrote it for Leave It to Me for the 1938 fall season on Broadway. Mary Martin sang it, and Weatherford, Texas had a favorite daughter.
And my daddy, he treats her.
At about the same time that Broadway found a new star in Mary Martin, veteran actor Walter Huston was doing his first musical, Knickerbocker Holiday. In one of the songs written by Kurt Vile and Maxwell Anderson, you can hear the melancholy and last hopes of a change of seasons for the whole world.
And the wine dwindles down to a precious brew, September, November, and these few vintage years I'd share with you. These vintage years I'd share with you.
And the days dwindle down to a precious few.
From May to September 1938, Czechoslovakia's last days of freedom slipped away as Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain underwent a seasonal change from confidence to anxiety to fear.
My policy has always been to try to ensure peace and the Führer's ready acceptance of my suggestion.
After my visits to Germany, I realized vividly how Herr Hitler feels that he must champion other Germans. He told me privately, and last night he repeated publicly, that after the Sudeten Germany...
How horrible,
fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country. Between people of whom we know nothing.
That far-off country was about 600 miles from London. Those unknown people were invented by Britain and France, an assortment of minorities brought together as a single nation in the agreements ending World War I, a people who looked to their creators to protect them from Hitler's territorial demands and his threats of war. Ignoring their combined military strength, which was greater than Germany's, ignoring legal and moral obligations, ignoring the pleas of Czech President Beneš that his people not be betrayed, ignoring all but their dread of war, Chamberlain and French Premier de Lagier decided that Hitler must have what he wanted. In a conference at Munich in the first hours of September 30th, the day before Hitler's deadline for war, Czechoslovakia was dismembered. Chamberlain went home to declare peace in our time.
We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
Some knew better. In the House of Commons, against angry voices that tried to shout him down, Winston Churchill said, "We have sustained a total defeat. And do not suppose that this is the end. It is only the beginning."
Americans followed the crisis in Europe every day through radio. For the first time, news programs competed with entertainment programs for airtime. The world used to be an ocean away. Now it was just a kilocycle away.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin. Moscow, Germany, and Russia today signed a non-aggression pact. They have agreed that neither country would declare war against one another, and that neither one would come to the aid of a third party.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time...
It is Halloween night, 1938, and those four words, "we interrupt this program," have become a familiar prefix to alarming news from Europe. Thousands of Americans listening to the CBS Mercury Theater on this night will not be able to separate fact from fantasy in Orson Welles' production of War of the Worlds.
There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. He strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars.
The thousands of people who rushed to their basements or who fled their homes in panic didn't hear the second half of the program and the tongue-in-cheek sign-off by Orson Welles.
The War of the Worlds has no further significance
than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
Wells said he could not believe that adults would be fooled by a story known to every child. But Americans had only recently learned to trust radio. Coming so soon after Munich, and with the new credibility of broadcast journalism, the Wells broadcast was the first demonstration for Americans of that threat to the senses when fact and fancy are fused within a single source.
We'll return to the home front in a moment.
I'd give up every possession if you'd come back to stay. I'd give a million tomorrows for just one yesterday.
When Arthur Godfrey recorded that song in 1939, you could almost hear millions of Americans say, Amen. The pollsters found that many Americans had become fatalists. They simply felt trapped in the present and more or less expected to be swept up in Europe's storms.
It's a twister! It's a twister!
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
And just like that, in MGM's Wizard of Oz, Judy Garland's sepia-toned Kansas world became the garish, technicolored Oz. A place populated by peace-loving but defenseless people. By a scarecrow, a lion, and a tin man who, like human folk, needed heart and courage and a clear mind. And by a timid soul who tried to keep his kingdom with bluff and bluster. Oz looked a lot like the real world outside the theater. If only things out there could be resolved as happily. If only everyone could click their heels in enchanted shoes and be whisked back to the secure world of home sweet yesterday.
Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns.
On September 1st, 1939, a tidal wave of German airplanes, armor, and infantry fell on Poland and swept all before it. Poland's air force was gone in 2 days, its army in 7, its capital in 16. Hitler had been threatening Poland ever since Munich, confident that what had worked before would work again. He would make territorial demands. Chamberlain and Daladier would listen and bargain and appease. He would invent some pretext for attack, and Britain and France would cower under his glance. In London, Prime Minister Chamberlain made one last effort to avoid war. If Hitler would withdraw his troops, Britain would forget the whole thing.
I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
And not only at war, but isolated from all help, except help from the U.S. Some believed it was already too late for that. The American ambassador to Britain, Joseph P. Kennedy, thought Britain and France should bargain for peace. And Colonel Charles Lindbergh, America's favorite hero and best-known isolationist, troubled his admirers when he said that Germany was not the peril to beware.
If the white race is ever seriously threatened, it may then be time for us to take our part in its protection. To fight side by side with English French and Germans, but not with one against the other for our mutual destruction.
President Roosevelt thought otherwise. He declared a state of limited emergency, and he urged a change in America's neutrality laws to permit the sale of weapons to Britain and France. And he also made it clear that neutrality and moral indifference are not the same thing.
This nation will remain a neutral nation. But I cannot ask that every American remain neutral in thought as well. Even a neutral cannot be asked to close his mind or close his conscience.
We're on number 12 platform at Waterloo Station, one of the 10 big metropolitan stations that are engaged today on the evacuation of London's school children. Some of them reported very early at their schools, as early as 5 o'clock. None of them knew then, and none of them know now, actually where they're going to. The reason of not telling them is that with anxious parents saying goodbye to their children, they had a feeling that they might try and follow them.
What?
1 minute, the train's leaving in 1 minute, is it? Well, now, children, come on, give them a song as you go. What about giving them the Lambeth Walk? Come on.
We'll be back on the home front in a moment. In 1939, Hollywood did some of its best work, providing audiences with The Wizard of Oz, Wuthering Heights, Dark Victory, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And David O. Selznick produced a movie based on the first novel of a Georgia housewife, Margaret Mitchell.
I've loved you more than I've ever loved anyone. And I've waited longer for you than I've ever waited for any woman.
Let me alone!
Scarlett, kiss me. Kiss me.
Clark Gable is Rhett Butler, and Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. Scarlett, for all her selfish ways, said something that meant something to Americans in that Depression era.
God is my witness. As God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor any of my food. If I have to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
Clark Gable didn't get an Oscar for the role only he could have played. But almost everybody else connected with the movie did win an Academy Award, including Hattie McDaniel.
And then this evening, Miss Scarlett, she shouted to the door, and she said the funeral's set for tomorrow morning. And he says, you try that, and I killed you tomorrow. Do you think I'd want to put my child in the dark when she's so scared of it?
No black had ever won an Oscar before McDaniel's wonderfully scrappy and poignant performance. But because she played a well-loved and loyal slave, it was possible for Americans to honor one black actress without upsetting their attitude about blacks in general. In the 1930s, the big bands were all white or all black, until Benny Goodman broke the color line. In 1935, Goodman was playing arrangements by jazz genius Fletcher Henderson that distinguished the band from all others and set the direction for swing music. But no theater or ballroom would permit Henderson to appear with the band. In 1936, Goodman brought in pianist Teddy Wilson to make up a trio with himself and Gene Krupa. The hotels let Wilson play with the trio, but not with a full band. Like many other black performers, the richly gifted contralto Marian Anderson saw stages go dark at her approach. In the spring of 1939, on a national tour, she was barred from singing at Washington, D.C.'s Constitution Hall. So Eleanor Roosevelt and Interior Secretary Harold Ickes, with FDR's blessings, arranged for Marian Anderson to sing outdoors at the Lincoln Memorial. On the eve of the new decade of the 1940s, the United States, despite all of its whites-only signs and all of its ghettos of the streets and of the heart, was the world's one great hope against the bigotry, the racism, and the ethnic hatreds that were covering people in Asia in mass graves, putting entire nations into chains, and packing Europe's Jews into railroad boxcars. A nation that had not yet embraced all of its own sons and daughters would be called upon to defend the whole family of humankind.
Once I prophesied that this generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. That prophecy comes true. To us, much is given. More is expected. This generation will nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth.
A word about our next program on the home front in a moment. In 1940, this was a song that was near the top of the surveys. Not of popular music, but of popular opinion.
Rock-a-bye, my baby, there ain't gonna be no war. There ain't gonna be no war over here.
But then came the fall of France, the Battle of Britain, and a peacetime draft. Many young Americans now in military uniform had a new song to sing.
Goodbye, dear, I'll be back in a year, 'cause I'm in the army now. Don't I look handsome dressed up like this? Stop your crying and give your soldier a kiss.
1940, next on the home front. For Edward Brown and Frank Gorin, this is William B. Williams. So long, world.
That was part one of The Homefront. Before I present the next installment, I would like to take this opportunity to thank my fellow MSS crew members for their enthusiastic recommendation of this presentation. Ron Bond gave me a copy of the program quite a while ago with the words, "I think you'll like this." Joy Jackson was quick to comment that today was Veterans Day. And when I suggested playing What You Are Now Hearing, the idea was greeted with a lot of applause and cheering. Once again, here is part two of The Homefront.
Hello, world. This is William B. Williams, and this is The Homefront.
This changing world, this changing scene, where is it taking us? What does it mean? As long as we're certain of each other, we know we don't have to be afraid. These changing times we rise above. We have no time for them. We have our love, and love is the only thing that still remains the same. Through all this changing world.
This is William B. again, and that was Ray Eberly singing with the Glenn Miller Band about the changing world of 1940. The world, for many Americans that year, meant standing in line to see any movie that was in color, discovering a hot new singer named Sinatra, snapping up a new marvel from science, nylon stockings, betting that the Yankees could win their 12th pennant, and betting that President Roosevelt wouldn't seek or couldn't win a third term. But more than anything, 1940 meant worrying about the war that was going on in Europe and arguing about it. Could the United States avoid involvement in Europe's affairs? Should it? All that happened a long time ago, of course, but there's always something new and fascinating and important to be found by tuning in on history when it was still current events. And that's what I like to do now with my colleagues Frank Gorin and Edward Brown. Just listen in on that old year of 1940 when it was a new year. In just a moment, we'll be part of that changing world. We'll be back on the home front of 1940. See you there. New Year's Eve, 1939, Times Square in New York City. People everywhere you look, more than 2 million. They did it every year, pressing in on the New York Times building and keeping watch on a 300-pound ball of lights strung up on a flagpole on the roof. When 1939 got to within 60 seconds of goodbye and good riddance, that ball would start inching its way down. And when it touched bottom, the worst 10 years that most Americans could remember would come to an end. There was music everywhere, swing and sweep, live and out of jukeboxes, and dancers covered every inch of floor space.
Oh, yes, they were echoes of the Roaring Twenties. They still did the Charleston in 1939, just for old time's sake. But anybody within range of the Will Bradley Band wanted to hear something that was brand new, something called Boogie Woogie. The critics hated it. The kids loved it. No New Year's Eve, no matter how brash and bright, is without its blues. And underneath all the noise of December 31st, 1939, were nervous feelings about the war in Europe. The newspapers were predicting that Hitler would soon invade England and France. But his army hadn't marched anywhere in 3 months. Maybe it was already over there. Maybe not.
There were no bright lights in England on New Year's Eve. There would be no bell ringing at midnight. No noises that might be confused with an air raid alert, just in case the bombers came. Paris on New Year's Eve looked her old self, still the postcard city, where love and song and wine tasted best. But years of depression had ruined the French economy, destroyed morale, and left France worn out and begging for peace. In Berlin, the state of war with Britain and France unsettled many Germans. They thought about the defeat and humiliation of 1918. They noticed all the gray uniforms of the Wehrmacht among the gowns and tuxedos. They recognized the blend of jest and fatalism in their midnight toast to death in the new year.
And then it moved. The 300-pound ball of lights on top of the Times building was on its way down. No one seemed to mind anymore that the temperature was 10 degrees below freezing. No one cared for the moment about great issues. All that mattered for the moment was that the old was ending and the new was beginning. All that mattered for the moment was the moment. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, of lights went dark, and suddenly there were other lights, bigger and brighter. On both sides of the flagpole were giant-sized numbers, 1940. In that moment, something more than a new year and a new decade had begun. It was the start, really, of a new century. The 20th century, with its new demands on old ideas and strategies, had finally arrived. We'll return to the home front in a moment.
Papa's still in the factory. misery, 'cause he don't know what time it happens to be. The 5 o'clock whistle didn't blow, the whistle is broken, what do you know? If somebody don't find out what's wrong, my pop will be working all night long.
In 1940, Americans who went to work to the sound of a factory whistle were earning about $25 a week. Uncle Sam was taking less than 5% out of weekly paychecks. Gasoline cost 7 cents a gallon. A loaf of bread was 8 cents. Chuck roast cost 23 cents a pound. Beer was a dime. And haircuts cost 50 cents. People didn't complain too much about trying to make ends meet because for 10 million Americans without jobs, the Great Depression was still going on. There were more than 130 million people in the land then, a country so big that it took 15 hours to fly from New York to California. Most people were leery about flying and preferred to take the train or drive to stay on the ground and experience the land. From inside a coach car or the family car, the countryside was a comforting place. It always seemed unchanged and unchangeable.
This is Frank Gorham. On the first day of January 1940, the winter solstice was already a thing of the past. Across the cold, white heartland of America, the sun was rising again. Spring and then summer were hurrying up from the south to wake up the crickets and the lightning bugs and the lightning and the crawdads and the wildflowers that would soon enough adorn the month of May with yet another Midwestern spring. And the band concerts would be held again on humid Sunday evenings on the covered bandstand down by the river. And kids would chase fireflies through the dusk and capture them in mason jars. And people in the park would fan themselves and swat mosquitoes. And all of us kids could see from the highest tree in the last light the long, flat landscape of the country with its barns and silos and plowed earth. Remember when we rode our bikes to the haunted house at the edge of town next to Cudahy's cornfield? When we soared through space on a rope and splashed in the swimming hole? When your brother Dink and I built the fort in the junkyard? When you were 16, my village queen? When you wore a tulip? When, after we were married, we sat on the porch and listened to the ball game and waved to the neighbors across the street? Remember the high school prom and the band concerts and the bake sale and the church supper and the Labor Day picnic? Oh, those precious days. Down those years. Downstream.
In 1940, barbershop quartets were popular again after years in the musical wilderness, and many a new singing group adopted the style, or something vaguely like it. The Hoboken Four, for example, four guys from New Jersey who appeared in 1936 on Major Bowes' Amateur Hour on radio. One of them was named Sinatra.
I'm Frank Major. We're looking for jobs. How about it? Everyone that's ever heard us liked us. We think we're pretty good.
Oh, we'll shine up to you. Everybody come hide you, dear. You'll make the whole world shine.
Shine and sway your bluesy.
Ah.
Shine, start with your shoesy.
Ah.
The Hoboken Four didn't win first prize, but the major liked Frank well enough to take him on tour. After that, Frank hustled jobs in places like the Rustic Cabin in Alpine, New Jersey. He sang there, and he was also the head waiter.
And if I fell under the spell of your call, I would be caught in the undertow. And so you see, I've got to say no, no.
In 1939, Frank was being heard on WNEW, and that same year, he caught the ear of Harry James, who had left Benny Goodman to form his own band and needed a boy singer. The rest, as they say, is history. We'll be back on the home front in a moment.
It's make-believe ballroom time, the hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance.
That's the Glenn Miller Band with the theme music written and recorded especially for Martin Black, who opened the Make-Believe Ballroom for the first time in the 1930s. On one February day in 1940, Martin paid Glenn Miller a visit and a compliment.
Glenn, the purpose of this pleasant visit is to notify you and all of your friends that your band has been voted America's number one band on my last Make-Believe Ballroom poll. Congratulations, Glenn, and on behalf of the Make-Believe Ballroom and its listeners, here is a bronze plaque, and it's presented with our best wishes to you, Glenn Miller, America's number one dance band.
Thank you, Martin, and thanks to all of our Make-Believe Ballroom friends.
...1940 was a winning year for Glenn Miller. Matter of fact, 1940 looked like it might be a boom year all around. The war in Europe was still in Europe, but the demand for weapons, for national defense and for export, was boosting prices on Wall Street, opening factories and creating jobs. Some people believed the United States could have its cake and eat it too. Wartime prosperity without the war.
Rock-a-bye, my baby, there ain't gonna be no war. There ain't gonna be no war over here. Rock-a-bye, my baby, it's all on the other side. We ain't gonna need no ride of Paul Revere. We're gonna have peace and quiet, and if they start a riot, we'll sit right back and keep score. The only place you go marching to will be the corner grocery store. So rock-a-bye, my baby, there ain't gonna be no war.
I have seen war, and I hate war. I hope the United States will keep out of this war. I believe that it will.
While President Roosevelt was offering those assurances, he was also extending U.S. protection for British convoys far out into the Atlantic. Isolationists like Senator Gerald Nye said the president was just spoiling for a fight with German U-boats.
Maybe some of these steps, like the so-called steps short of war, will be called steps short of dictatorship.
But the isolationist had no quarrel with Roosevelt's request to Congress for a bigger army, a strong two-ocean navy, 50,000 warplanes, and a military alliance with the nations of Latin America.
Ay, 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 é o canto do pregoneiro que com sua harmonia traz alegria em salsa americana. Ay, ay, ay.
They called her the Brazilian bombshell. Carmen Miranda exploded on the American scene in the movie Down Argentine Way in 1940, the year that America went Latin. Suddenly, everybody was doing the conga and the rumba. Nightclubs and taverns put in a few potted palms and gave themselves Latin names. The Latin Love Fest on Broadway produced Cole Porter's Panama Hattie. Whatever the show may have done for FDR's good neighbor policy, it did wonders for the career of Ethel Merman.
In the spring of 1940, German forces overwhelmed Denmark, Norway, Holland, and Luxembourg, and by May 20th had broken Belgium's first line of defense, trapping hundreds of thousands of British, French, and Belgian soldiers around the port of Dunkirk, their backs to the English Channel. But on May 24th, Adolf Hitler made a mistake. He ordered his panzer divisions to halt their advance. He wanted to preserve those tanks for the invasion of France, and he was persuaded by Hermann Goering that the encircled enemy at Dunkirk could be finished off by the Luftwaffe. It took 48 hours for Hitler to recognize his error and set the panzers rolling again. But by then, it was too late. By then, the British commander, General Viscount Gort, had strengthened his defenses at Dunkirk and begun the evacuation of his army to England. By then, hundreds of vessels of all kinds were crossing to Dunkirk. Warships and sailboats, ferries, fishing boats, and pleasure craft, many of them piloted by civilian volunteers. Under air and artillery attack, long lines of men snaked over the beaches waiting to go aboard. Ground forces and the RAF battled to hold back the panzers and keep the Luftwaffe above the clouds, and they did their jobs well. Even so, Dunkirk was a horror. A French cargo ship hit by a bomb went down with 1,000 men on board. A ferry, overloaded and low in the water, hit a submerged wreck and its bottom was torn out. Two torpedo destroyers went down so fast, almost no one got off. Ships were burning everywhere. Men tried to swim out to the rescue craft, only to drown in the rough surf in its cover of blazing oil, or go down with the vessels that picked them up. On June 6th, the panzers finally broke through to the beaches, and 40,000 soldiers, almost all of them French, became prisoners of war. Britain's casualties amounted to some 60,000 men, dead, wounded, or captured. But more than 300,000 soldiers had escaped to England to live, and for many of them, to fight another day.
There was every kind of ship that I saw coming in this morning, and every one of them was crammed full of tired, battle-stained, and blood-stained British soldiers. Transport officers counted the men as they came ashore. No question of units, no question of regiments, no question even of nationality, for there were French and Belgian soldiers who had fought side by side with the British in the Battle of Flanders. All of them were tired. Some were completely exhausted. But the most amazing thing was that practically every man was reasonably cheerful, and most of them managed a smile.
In London, Britain's new Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, cautioned his people not to assign to the deliverance from Dunkirk the attributes of victory. Wars, he said, are not won by evacuations. But he knew the people had been inspired by the miracle at Dunkirk. He knew that they understood just how perilous their situation was and how lonely. And he told them that the price for standing up to Hitler would be paid for with their blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Winston Churchill, a bald bulldog of a man in his 60s, a man with so great a resolve and with so great a gift of speech that his words
would magnify British courage and force of arms.
Behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned great races. The Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer, as conquer we must, as conquer we shall.
We'll return to the home front in a moment.
Il avait de grands yeux très clairs, où parfois passaient des éclairs, comme au ciel passent les orages.
Edith Piaf and her Paris were one voice, proud, lovely, fragile, and tragic. In June 1940, when Hitler began his offensive against France, the voice of Paris was Premier Paul Reynaud, pleading in vain for clouds of American planes. It was the defiant voice of the radio, as the panzers rumbled nearer. A voice fading under the shouted declarations of war from Benito Mussolini in Rome, and the shouted glee of his ally in Berlin. Jackboots trumped on the Champs-Élysées. The swastika was raised on the Eiffel Tower. A disorganized, dispirited France had fallen.
Achtung, hier ist der Großdeutsche Rundfunk.
They signed the armistice papers at Compiègne, in the same railroad car where Marshal Foch had presided over Germany's submission to an armistice in 1918. Hitler sat in Foch's chair. Then he went to see the sights of Paris. Postcard Paris. Edith Piaf's Paris. Proud, lovely, fragile, tragic Paris.
Out of the hearts of these patriotic Americans came the chant, "We want Wilkie."
In the USA, the delegates to the Republican National Convention in 1940 got just what they wanted, a dark horse, a fresh face, just what was needed to deny President Roosevelt a third term. And when he tarred and feathered the New Dealers as power grabbers, Wendell Willkie sounded like a winner.
This is the scourge of government above the people, without the people, and in spite of the people.
One hot August afternoon, nearly a quarter million people tramped all over Elwood, Indiana, Wilkie's hometown, to hear his acceptance speech, to hear him explain again how he quit the Democrats in 1938 and found democracy in the Republican Party. He gave them plenty to cheer about.
We are here today to represent a sacred cause, the preservation of American democracy.
But soon, the crowd's excited approval retreated like a tide.
I believe that the forces of free enterprise must be regulated. I am opposed to business monopoly.
Something was wrong here. Wendell Willkie stood there among the sycamore roots of the American heartland, a grown-up Huck Finn with his rumpled suit and crop of unruly hair, a small-town boy who became a self-made man, stood there and supported many of FDR's policies. To their great confusion, Willkie spoke to his audience like the liberal he was and would always be. The political scene of 1940 turned ugly. Willkie was dogged by egg throwers, and despite his support of FDR's call for a peacetime draft and aid to Britain, he was hounded by the absurd whispered slogan that a vote for Willkie was a vote for Hitler. Near the end, his voice failing, he could barely make himself heard.
Join me in this crusade to save free America. Help, help. Please help us in this crusade.
Opposed by big labor and resented by many Republican leaders, Wilkie lost the election, but he won the admiration of President Roosevelt and of many millions of Americans and of history. At the same time that Wilkie was under siege during the campaign, racists, bigots, fascists, and rowdies of all kinds began commandeering seats at America First rallies so they could jeer at the mention of Roosevelt or the British or the Jews. In arenas where the German-American Bund held its rallies, the hating was even worse.
It should be the duty of every citizen to demand of the sponsors of the large programs to stop feeding the public the trash of the Winchells, the Cantors, the Burns, and Bernstein, and give the American public for a change a voice which really speaks the American language without a Jewish accent.
By linking themselves with the earnest cause of neutrality, the Bunds and other hate gangs helped ruin that cause. Americans were incensed when the Bund draped the swastika next to the Stars and Stripes, and when nasties at America First rallies booed a song that Americans of every opinion had taken as their own from the first time they heard Kate Smith sing it. The haters booed because the song had been written by a Jew, Irving Berlin. Return to the home front in a moment. There were a few American movies in 1940, and only a few, that raised an alarm about the Nazis. But even then, they trail far behind events. One movie that had nothing to do with the war, and yet had everything to do with it, was Warner's Newt Rockne, All American. Pat O'Brien starred as the famed Notre Dame coach, and Ronald Reagan played the part of a football star, George Gipp. O'Brien's locker room pep talk added a battle cry to American folklore.
I'm going to tell you something I've kept to myself for years. None of you ever knew George Gipp, but you all know what a tradition he is at Notre Dame. And the last thing he said to me, Rock, he said, sometime when the team is up against it and the brakes are beating the boys, tell them to go out there with all they got and win just one for the Gipper.
But what are we waiting for?
There were some Americans in 1940 who couldn't wait on the sidelines of the war any longer. Hundreds of them joined the Royal Canadian Air Force. An American volunteer ambulance corps was already on duty in England. American public opinion now favored a military draft as the best defense against Hitler crossing the Atlantic. On October 29th, the first numbers in the draft lottery were called in a ceremony at the War Department. Numbers mixed in a glass bowl, the same bowl used in the World War I draft, stirred up with a stick made of wood from Independence Hall in Philadelphia. And the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, drew the first number, blindfolded with a linen cloth taken from a chair used in the signing of the Declaration of Independence. He drew the number and handed it to President Roosevelt.
The first number drawn by the Secretary of War is serial number 158.
Goodbye, dear. I'll be back in a year, 'cause I'm in the Army now. They took my number out of a hat, and there's nothing a guy can do about that. But when I get back, I'll be all tanned and brown, and we'll buy that cottage just outside of town. So goodbye, dear, I'll be back in a year. Don't forget that I love you.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. And so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now.
Americans could not sit by their radios and not feel connected with England under fire. They were stirred by Churchill's words and by Edward R. Murrow's broadcast on CBS about RAF flyers in combat above their own villages, frustrating Hermann Göring's boast that terror bombing would lay British morale to ruins. Americans could not sit by their radios during the London Blitz and not remember hearing some important part of themselves, the innocence of their own children, in the innocent voices of young Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret, when they spoke to the thousands of British children who'd been evacuated for safekeeping.
When peace comes, remember, it will be for us, the children of today, to make the world of tomorrow a better and happier place. My sister is by my side, and we are both going to say goodnight to you. Come on, Margaret. Good night, children. Good night, and good luck to you all.
Adolf Hitler now faced a truth he could not deny. For the first time, he had lost. He had not believed Churchill was serious when he said the British people would never surrender, that they would persevere and prevail. It never occurred to Hitler that it would never occur to the British to do anything else.
It is no war of chieftains or of princes, of dynasties or national ambitions. It is a war of peoples and of causes. There are vast numbers, not only in this island, but in every land, who will render faithful service in this war, but whose names will never be known, whose deeds will never be recorded. This is a war of the unknown warrior. But let all strive without failing, in faith or in duty, and the dark curse of Hitler will be lifted from our age.
We'll be right back.
about our next program on the home front in a moment. FDR is sworn in for the third time as president and commits the United States to the defense of Britain. American ships on convoy duty do battle with U-boats. Hitler turns against Russia. In the United States, mobilization picks up speed and Hollywood lends a hand. It was a year of the Four Freedoms and the Liberty Ships, Sergeant York and the Lone Ranger, songs of the Volga Boatmen and the Reuben James. It was a year that ended with America's worst fears realized with warplanes over the Pacific. 1941, next on the home front. For Edward Brown and Frank Gorin, this is William B. Williams. So long, world.
That was part two of The Home Front. Though I'd greatly enjoy playing the rest of this multi-part program, the fact is that I have run out of time, and I'm actually into overtime. I would very much like to know if you've enjoyed this Home Front view of World War II, and in order to find out, I'm going to release the key and return the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish. For as long as you wish. Just remember, be nice to one another. On behalf of myself and the rest of the MSS crew, have a great night, a great weekend, and the sweetest of dreams. This has been an MSS Crew production.